Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'll be filling in for Kathleen this week and next. And, of course, this is Monday afternoon, the 26th of January. And this hour is devoted to political discussion as we move into all things political. Lots of political news to talk about, as always. Here's how you get in touch. By phone, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and you can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. Leave your comments or questions there, and we'll be sure to get them on the air. My guest this hour is Jamel Bowie, Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race. Jamel Bowie, welcome to The Kathleen Dunn Program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, no shortage of political news again this week. Last week, the president gave his State of the Union speech. And I know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, the big takeaway was a zinger that he got in. And maybe a little less attention was paid to some of the policy initiatives that the president laid out. Given the political climate in Washington, the handicapping is that none of these are going anywhere. What was the president trying to accomplish with that speech, do you think?
I think what he was trying to do is sort of turn the conversation away from sort of the state of the economy in terms of, in terms of unemployment, in terms of sort of the negative things. I think he was trying to, and what he said was, we are at a point where we will grow out of the recession. The recession's over, our growth is healthy, unemployment's going down, wages are beginning to go up. And so what we need to do now is talk about how we distribute the gains of the recovery. I think a good way to think about the State of the Union is it is in a way Obama's first post-economic crisis State of the Union. For the past 5 years, the economy has been sort of, was either in recession or teetering on the edge of falling back into it, but now we are safely away from that danger. So what do we do next?
Well, and I guess depending on your point of view, the idea that we're post-recession is either resonates or it doesn't, because certainly for a lot of people in the United States, the recovery didn't get to them. And so we have
right.
A lot of people who are still struggling. And what was in this for them?
I was going to say that's exactly right. And I think the president was trying to talk to those people. In this speech, he mentions the Affordable Care Act. He sort of calls for higher minimum wages, for more paid leave, for stronger child care subsidies, for stronger subsidies for two-parent households where both parents work. It's sort of the same, basket of policies Obama has promoted in the past, but with an aim towards expanding their reach and expanding their scope a bit.
Okay, so the president is officially a lame duck. He doesn't have any more campaigns to run, and as he pointed out, he won the last two. And so he's really got nothing to lose here. But what about the Democratic Party? He's still, I guess politically he's the head of the party. How is what he does over the next 2 years going to affect the chances of the Democrats in 2016, both in terms of the race for the White House and congressional seats? What does he need to do there, and did he start to position the party for the next election, and how do you think he did?
Well, the most important thing that Obama – the most important, it's not something he can do, really, just the most important thing about Obama that will play into the 2016 elections is his approval rating, which kind of depends more, in the absence of any kind of war or anything like that, depends more on the state of the economy in 2016 than it does anything in particular he's done. And so right now, I think at Gallup, his current approval rating is 50%, and the seven-day average is 49%. If that persists through the year and into 2016, then whoever is the Democratic nominee will be much better positioned to win the White House. Alan Abramowitz, who is a political scientist at Emory University and who writes for University of Virginia's Crystal Ball, did a chart last week that sort of shows you presidential approval rating and then a share of the two-party vote. And if Obama enters next year with the approval rating of around 49-50%, then the nominee can expect around like 49.5% of the two-party vote, which is, you know, that what that means that it will be very close, that campaigns will matter. And so in terms of the campaigns, I think what Obama did with the State of the Union was sort of set the parameters of for where the Democratic Party, I think, is going over the next year and a half. And specifically, it's going to take its war on women message from 2012 and kind of expand it and soften it into sort of a general push for women's economic empowerment and also women's reproductive rights. And so to think about women's issues in a more expansive way. And so that means I would expect the 2016 nominee to be talking about universal pre-K, to be talking about sick leave, to be talking about all these things that make it easier for women who work to maintain families and for women who stay at home to you know, better support their families.
Okay, so let's flip this around and talk about the Republicans for a moment here, because we laid out what the president was trying to do and what the Democrats need to do. Give us your take on the Republican response to Mr. Obama's State of the Union speech, and then of course they made historic gains in the House, and they took over the Senate, so it's their Congress to run. There've already been a few little controversies, but let's talk first about their response to the State of the Union message, and then as they've taken over Congress, what they've been doing since then.
Yeah, as far as the Republican response goes, yeah, I thought it was delivered well. Joni Ernst is a good speaker. I think the sort of the challenge for the GOP is it hasn't really had to run against Obama or run against the Democrats in a scenario where things are getting better economically, and not just in kind of a marginal way, like, oh, at least we're not in collapse, but things are actively getting better for many Americans. And you can see this in the response, which focused very heavily on things like the Keystone XL pipeline, which focused on deregulation and tax cuts, when those are sort of – it's not clear that those are the kinds of policies and solutions that would actually address the national concern of stagnant wages and income inequality. So I think, if anything, their response to the State of the Union highlighted how much work I think the Republicans need to do to become a part of this conversation and to offer a meaningful alternative to President Obama, which I'm sure the GOP has a meaningful alternative. But I'm not quite sure they're there yet in being able to articulate it for the broader public.
800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, the number to call to join the program. Of course, you can also use email, talk@WPR.org, and social media. The Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook and Twitter if you want to ask a question of our guest or make a comment about political news. By all means, do so at any one of those venues, 800-486-8655. Jamel Bowie is my guest. He is a Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race. Okay, so let's move away from the State of the Union. Over the course of the last week, the Republicans have kind of set up their agenda in the House and the Senate. Right away, it looks like we're going to see a number of social issues tackled. There was a rather interesting situation in the House regarding a vote on an abortion bill. Let's discuss that a little bit and kind of see what's the overall Republican strategy here. It looks like they're trying to avoid taking votes on some controversial subjects.
Right, and there's pressures in both directions, right? Many of the new members of the House Republican Caucus and certainly of the Senate Republican Caucus ran on an anti-abortion platform, ran on doing more in the federal government to limit the scope of abortion rights. At the same time, you know, depending on the surveys you look at, depending on the questions people ask, this can either be kind of only marginally popular or pretty unpopular. And so I think, you know, especially in the House where how Republican leadership has had trouble sort of controlling, is the best word, some of the more ideological members, there's difficulty about – the difficult question is how do we move forward on these promises and priorities, limiting the scope of abortion rights using the federal government without doing so in a way that alienates us with Americans who may not be entirely comfortable with this push. And in this particular case, I think, you know, many Republican moderates and pragmatists just didn't think it would be good optics for the party to be discussing sort of the scope of a rape exception or an incest exception. So they kind of shut the conversation down.
Yeah, and that it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out within the party, because you've got some people who are saying, "Hey, look, if we want to win in 2016, we have to have a broader message, and we can't continue to antagonize large swaths of the population with some of these issues." On the other hand, you have, as you point out, a group of people who are ideologically driven and who don't care about that. They think they're right, and they're going to fight for what they believe in. It should be an interesting session for Speaker Boehner, who survived a challenge to his leadership as Speaker. And what did you think of the way he handled the aftermath of that? I mean, a number of people who opposed him basically discovered that they no longer had chairmanships or membership, even in committees that they wanted.
You know, I think that's the right way to go about it. You know, I tend to think that it is better for party leadership to be able to have as much sort of control over members in their caucuses than not. And so if I were John Boehner and I faced a challenge from members and there are members who supported that challenge and I won, I would definitely use my influence and my power to elevate supporters and punish people who won those challengers. It's important. I mean, it's important in large part because if you're trying to actually do something with the power you wield, trying to advance an agenda, you need discipline. You know, without discipline, you get things like the shutdown fiasco of 2013 when Boehner just could not bring critical members of his caucus to heel. You need to be able to do that. So for Boehner, who has had trouble trying to maintain unity and cohesiveness, this kind of punishment for members who opposed him, I think, is entirely appropriate. It's what a party leader does.
Well, you pretty much have to expect it. And if he hadn't, that would have sent a pretty clear message that he didn't feel all that secure in his authority.
Right.
I wonder what that means going forward, because in the last session, the speaker seemed to really have a great deal of difficulty getting people to fall into line and doing what he wanted, including at least one instance where he had to go to the Democrats to get votes for something that the House needed to do. Did he send a clear signal that, hey, this is not going to happen again, and everybody better fall in line or else?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it depends on the issue at hand. I know there are almost certainly things where Boehner can get Democratic votes and it's okay. It's sort of an understood agreement. I think what is key for the next year and a half really is for Republican leaders in both the House and the Senate to make sure that they are not embarrassing their potential presidential candidates. I think that's really kind of the top concern. How can we guide and navigate our majority to actually, A, giving a positive example of what Republican leadership looks like, and then, B, keeping our members from doing anything that could be used against a presidential candidate? I mean, remember in 2012, Barack Obama ran heavily against the House Republicans, very much said, if you elect Mitt Romney, you'll be empowering people like this. And I think Republicans don't want a repeat of that.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to change the discussion a little bit. There was the first volleys have been fired in the 2016 presidential election, a gathering in Iowa for social conservatives there, featured a number of Republican candidates, including our own Governor Scott Walker. and others. There were some notable absences as well. Mitt Romney wasn't there. Jeb Bush wasn't there. Bobby Jindal wasn't there. And there were some others. But the ones who showed up had had a chance to state their case to a very sympathetic audience. We'll talk about that and about the race for president in 2016, which, as I said, seems to have already kicked off, if it hadn't prior to this. And we'll discuss that and take your calls and questions also after the break. 800-486-8655. What did you think? What do you think is the hottest political story right now? I'll throw that out, too. Call and let us know what you think is a really important political story, whether it's being talked about or not. You can do that at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. Leave your comment or question there. My guest is Jamel Bui, a Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race. He and I will be back in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's all things political. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. And my guest, Jamel Bui, a Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race. Well, the annual the Freedom Summit was held in Iowa over the weekend, and it's a chance for Republican candidates who think they might want to run for president in the next election to talk to people that they'll need to court in order to be successful. And one headline, the headline on the CBS website, the story about this event, said was, "Have Iowa conservatives found a new star for 2016? Let's talk about what happened in Iowa over the weekend and get your take on this. And maybe we'll get some callers who want to join in as well at 800-486-8655.
Yeah, so, you know, you had in Iowa pretty much the Tea Party candidate, presidential hopefuls going out to, you know, do their thing. And from what I understand, Scott Walker and Ted Cruz really, lit up the crowd. People really loved them. Like, Huckabee did well. But it was really Scott Walker and Ted Cruz's show to steal, which doesn't really come as a big surprise. You know, Cruz has sort of tried to make his name as the person who can best represent the interest and the priorities of the kind of grassroots social conservatives that you see in Iowa. And Scott Walker, who came to national fame as someone who survived a recall attempt, who beat back the unions, who won re-election, despite governing as a very kind of ideological conservative, I think he appeals to this same crowd for similar reasons.
Well, of course, the Iowa caucuses are a year away, but the comments from Republican operatives in Iowa, influential ones, bloggers and others in the party who were there, basically said the consensus is Walker was very impressive and had a terrific debut, and he's being considered a serious dark horse candidate. Another candidate who got great reaction from the crowd, Ben Carson. He drew a lot of applause at that Iowa summit as well. And so, is there a clear favorite at this point in the GOP race? I know it's way early for that, but that has never stopped us before. What's your take on this?
I do think that there are favorites. There's a favorite in the race. I don't think it's someone like Ben Carson, who I wouldn't even really call like a serious candidate. I think he's someone who is there for the publicity, and that's really about it. I'd say if you're going to label someone a favorite, it might be Jeb Bush, not because he's especially popular with the kinds of people who were in Iowa this past weekend, but because he seems to have a good deal of institutional support within the party, a good deal of donor support and activist support. And so those are the kinds of things that really determine who ends up winning. Right behind him, I would put Scott Walker, who occupies, if not a similar place as Bush in kind of the taxonomy of Republicans, one adjacent to it. He's obviously much more conservative, but also has a strong business appeal, has a deep relationships with key donors to the Republican Party. So I would put those two sort of at the front of the pack, with figures like Marco Rubio and Chris Christie just behind. Those four men are look like the kinds of people who win Republican nominations. So I have less, I guess I'm less impressed with Cruz and Rand Paul, who are generally candidates like that who may have, you know, significant support within the party, but are idiosyncratic on certain issues or too deeply divisive on others. Those aren't the kinds of people who win nominations.
Mm. Let's take a phone call. Jim is with us from Milwaukee. Jim, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
Yes, what I'd like to talk about today deals with the lack of honesty in the American voter and the unwillingness to deal with the facts. And I think if you look at things from an overall framework, just in the DiCaprio Wall Street film alone, we saw people willing to cheat others in order to achieve success in business, and I think that applies as well to politics. And one place that it was laid out for us rather nicely was an article that I happened to stumble across when I was working the net, and it was from the Boston Globe, and it was called How Facts Backfire, and it was done on 7/11/2010 under Boston Globe Ideas and Articles. And in the article, it talked about some research at the University of Michigan, and they found, this was done in 2005 and 2006, and the basic hypothesis that people would normally run would be that if people have the facts, they'll be able to make an educated, good decision in terms of politics. But in reality, the way it worked is people reacted very differently to that, because the general idea was that it was absolutely threatening to admit that you were wrong. And this is a phenomenon known as backfire, which is a natural defense mechanism to avoid cognitive dissonance when you find out that you're wrong on something. And so because people have underlying beliefs that they want to be supported and sometimes are not supported by facts, they can twist those beliefs so that they fit the preconceived notions in a better way. And so ultimately, people can ignore the reality and can come out with, you know, twisted, distorted ideas to support what they wanted to believe in the first place. And I think that this is a big impediment to voting. And the interesting thing is, if you check things out and Google things, it isn't hard for a person, regardless of what party you voted for, you can very easily find things that show that the person that you voted for did some really bad things. Obama, for example, didn't prosecute the torturers from the Bush administration. And if you look under MENA Arkansas and Barry Seals and read some of the books on Clinton, you'll find some things about drugs that relate to Clinton and the Bush family that are not very positive for any of them and could have resulted in impeachment and jail for many people. And the same thing with the Republicans, just the selection of a person like Sarah Palin or for vice president, and finally, with Mitt Romney, I don't ever recall reading in the Bible where somebody got in a room with his disciples and said that he couldn't work with 47% of the people. So with any candidate, if you even do a cursory search for ideas, you can find some facts that work against people from your own party. And since only God is perfect, I think it's salutary for people to be able to admit that they're wrong, because then they have an opportunity to learn something.
Okay, Jim, a lot to chew on here, and I'd like to get my guest in on this. Thanks so much for your call. It has been scientifically proven that sometimes exposure to facts can actually have the opposite effect that you might think if you were thinking logically, that people sometimes behave emotionally, and when they hear facts that contradict their beliefs become stronger. What kind of effect has that sort of thing had, do you think, on the political rhetoric that we're getting these days, Jim Elbouy?
I mean, you know, I think my general take on things like this is that they've always been the case. People have always humans just think in ways that are motivated. They just humans, no one, or very, very few people pick up their beliefs through the judicious weighing of facts and coming to a logical conclusion. We all come by way of our beliefs, by the things we learn as children, as teenagers, as young adults, from our parents, from our peers, from our elders. And what ends up happening is we bolster those beliefs by looking for facts that that strengthen them, not in some sinister way, but just, you gravitate towards things that confirm what you know. And so that kind of motivated reasoning is just a part of how humans work, and it always will be and always has been. And so, the thing I always say or think is that, our politics, there have been periods where politics have been much better than they are now. There are periods where politics have been much worse than they are now. And people have more or less been the same in the way they think and the way they use information they receive. If our politics are especially bad right now, I think it has more to do with whatever particular feature of the current moment, whether it's institutional configuration, whether it's the kind of economy we live in, all these macro things, I think have a bigger effect on the way our politics are currently organized than the particular behavior of voters. Because I just don't think the behavior of voters has ever really changed that much.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We want your take on the politics of the day at 800-486-8655. Jamel Bowie is my guest. He is a staff writer for Slate covering politics, policy, and race. One story that I stumbled across this morning that it kind of jumped out at me because I thought it was a little odd. I want to bring this up and get your thoughts on this. Univision, the biggest Spanish language network, has been shut out of the Republican debates for the 2016 campaign. The thought is that the Republicans really don't want to talk about immigration. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just kind of what the pundits are saying, and those are a dime a dozen. But the fact that Univision has been shut out of the Republican debates for 2016, what message does that send to the Latino community, which Republicans lost to President Obama in a big way in 2012?
Oh, it certainly doesn't say anything good. I think, honestly, what I think it says is that it's not that Republicans don't respect the Latino community, but that they're just not interested in talking about the key issue that affects many, many Latinos. And that's a problem. I think Latino voters are open to voting for Republicans. I think they are only open to voting for Republicans if Republicans can promise some sort of action on immigration. But as it stands, the party is very restrictionist in its approach to immigration. The loudest voices are people like Representative Steve King, who essentially supports mass deportation. And something like this kind of, I think, bolsters the impression that the GOP just has no real interest in engaging with Latino voters, although I don't think that's true of many Republicans, but that, I think, is the impression the party creates.
Well, I just want to read a quote from Univision spokesman Jose Zamora. He said, "There is a very simple political reality. Hispanics will decide the 2016 presidential election." Is that true, do you think?
It depends, honestly. I can certainly imagine a situation where that happens. It would be a very, very tight election, and it takes you long to explain, but it would be so tight that even then it would be a bit of a stretch. But it's certainly true that Latinos will play a very important part in determining who is the next president. And for that reason alone, and even if they didn't, honestly, their fellow Americans, their voices count and their voices matter. So you should want to engage with them.
We haven't talked much about the Democratic Party's issues going forward. They're in the minority in Congress. They do still occupy the White House, President Obama, in the last 2 years of his last term. And we really haven't there's been a lot of talk, but nobody has really identified themselves as a candidate for president. Still a lot of talk about Hillary Clinton and a possible Clinton campaign to run for the White House. But other people are pushing people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren with a little more populist message. But certainly nowhere near as clear on the Democratic side who wants to be involved as it is on the Republican. What's your take on what the Democrats need to do in Congress and who's going to emerge eventually as the Democratic candidate for president?
Well, you know, as far as the Democrats need to do in Congress, I think it's more a matter of just protecting Obama's priorities, finding ways to get Obama's nominees through Congress, and you know, finding ways to create, to make Republicans look bad. Basically, I mean, that's what a minority party does when they're in the minority. So offering amendments, offering bills that sort of force Republicans to take hard choices. And this is, it'll be easier in the Senate than it will the House, where in general, senators just have much more autonomy than House members do.
You mentioned amendments. Before we move on there, I want to catch your next point, but I wanted to point out there was something that happened on Friday in the Senate. Actually, it was Thursday night, having to do with amendments. Mitch McConnell, who's now the majority leader in the Senate, has said things are going to run differently. Everybody's going to have a chance to vote on amendments and then basically shut everything down on Thursday night. Democrats wanted to continue to discuss their amendments until Friday, and he said, no, we're done here. We're just going to vote them all at once. And I believe that's – I'm way oversimplifying what took hours to do. But is it going to be business as usual in the Senate? Is there still going to be gridlock? Are the Republicans going to be able to get anything done there?
I mean, I think there will be gridlock, just because I'm not sure if Democrats are going to let things go through very much. But it's an open question to see if McConnell lets Democrats give more amendments. My hunch, this will be a bit more generous, but not much more. Don't want to get embarrassed. Just to answer your previous question about the Democratic nominee for president, though, I think the clear answer that it's right now it's Hillary Clinton as the front runner, is the most likely nominee. And so, you know, nothing's changed up so far. Nothing's changed so far, and any of her potential competitors just don't seem strong enough.
Or interested enough. I mean, for all the talk of drafting Elizabeth Warren, she doesn't seem at all interested in running for president and has said publicly that she's not. Hillary Clinton has been in this position before, being the clear front runner, even without declaring her intent to run. And then along came Barack Obama out of nowhere. Is there another Democrat in the weeds someplace the way Barack Obama was previously, where somebody's going to come out of left field that we really haven't paid much attention to yet?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more of all things political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen is on vacation for the next 2 weeks. Well-deserved vacation. I hope she's someplace warm and sunny. And so I'll be sitting in for the next couple of weeks on the Kathleen Dunn program. And invite you to join us here on the Kathleen Dunn Show for all things political. You can do that in a number of ways. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number that you can call from pretty much anywhere, although I'm told that number doesn't work in Australia. 800-486-8655. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show. And an email, talk@wpr.org. We've got an email to share when we come back after the break. We'll continue our all things political discussion with Jamel Bowie, Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for the vacationing Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's all things political on the Kathleen Dunn Show this Monday afternoon. I'm John Munson, in for the vacationing Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back in a couple of weeks. I'm sure all rested and, I'm hoping, sporting a nice tan. All Things Political is your chance to weigh in on the political news of the day. 800-486-8655 is the way to do that. Jamel Bowie is my guest. He is a staff writer for Slate covering politics, policy, and race. 800-486-8655. One of the other stories that that has come up in the last few days has to do with an invitation that Speaker of the House John Boehner made to Benjamin Netanyahu, the president of Israel, who is in his own reelection campaign 2 weeks away from elections in Israel. Speaker Boehner invited President Netanyahu to speak to a joint session of Congress. And this was seen as kind of crossing a line. There was obviously more to this story than just that, but let's talk about that a little bit and some of the reaction to it and whether or not this was a smart move, how this is going to play out going forward. And I know there's already been some backlash against President Netanyahu in his own country over this visit, which some are calling a political stunt. So what's your take on this?
I tend to agree with the criticism. You know, the administration is trying to broker a sensitive deals with Iran on nuclear weapons, on security, and this really seems like an attempt to influence that negotiation process. So it strikes me as just very inappropriate for the Speaker of the House to do this. There's that old cliche that politics ends at the water's edge, and apparently for this particular speaker it does not, and I think that's a shame. But we'll see, we'll see what happens.
Well, the first story to come out was that President Netanyahu would not be meeting with President Obama. And
right.
For those who didn't understand the policy there, they went, what? Why isn't, it's a head of state visiting. Why wouldn't the president visit with him? But there's a firm policy this close to an election in the country of the visiting head of state. There's no White House meeting because the appearance then would be given that the president is interfering with the politics of some other country, which, of course, isn't something we want to do. Well, Speaker Boehner apparently didn't feel that that was a problem. But there's more to it than this. When you look at the story there, this is actually kind of part of a dispute that goes back a number of years between the president and the speaker.
Yes, that's right.
President Obama invited the president of South Korea to speak to a joint session of Congress without informing Speaker Boehner first, as some people are saying this is payback.
Yeah, maybe it's payback. Maybe Boehner has a very long memory about these sort of things. I'm not sure. I don't have enough insight. I would say that I think in general it's probably good for respective, leaders of the executive branch and the legislative branch sort of like let each other know and ask permission for these sorts of things. I think it just does not set a good precedent for either to be inviting heads of state to talk without informing the other. It just doesn't, I don't know. I have no particular expertise here, but it strikes me as something you shouldn't do.
And it's probably an issue that outside the punditocracy, no one really cares about, as evidenced by the lack of phone calls we've had on this topic. Here's that we've got a really cool email, though, I think from Adam in La Crosse, who writes he found Joni Ernst's Republican response to the State of the Union address to be not well delivered. He goes on to say, quote, I am still pretty sure that Joni Ernst is a robot. Seriously, there was absolutely no emotion in her voice at all. In terms of substantive issues with the Republican Congress, can your guest try to explain why the first issues that the Republicans are voting on are issues that no Republican ran on? Which Republicans ran their campaigns on the XL pipeline, more tax cuts for the rich and corporations, and less regulation for the banks?
So, I mean, I think the right way to think about this kind of thing is that, individual candidates run on a number of things. They express any number of priorities. And while when in office, they usually try to act on those priorities. But in general, people are running as representatives of their parties. And the Republican Party has a very well-defined agenda around all of these items and has consistently said, from 2008 to the present, that if they get power, these are the kinds of things they will do. And so with this newfound majority, their first moves are to exactly do these things. And maybe, as the year goes on, as we enter next year, those individual lawmakers will begin to act on the priorities they set to their voters. But, broadly, this is what the GOP said it would do.
Yeah, it should be no secret to anyone that they were in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline. I mean, that's been a cornerstone of their platform for a long time. There was a period of time when people thought that the president agreed with that, but now he's come out saying, you know what, if you send this Keystone bill to my desk, I'm going to veto it. We'll have to see how that plays out. Let's take a phone call. Before we do, I'll give the number again and let you know that this is your chance to weigh in on some political story that you heard and that we have maybe haven't talked about this hour. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Andy is with us from Madison. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you can hear me. One of the things that's been bothering me for some time is that the Republicans have been pretty unanimous with the idea that you know, we can't raise minimum wages. We can't make provisions for the less successful in the top 5%. And you know, number one, it's religious, it's morality, it's lack of compassion. You know, the Bible says, "Take care of your brother," and I don't hear much of that with the Republicans. That's all.
Andy, thanks. Andy, thanks for the call. Jamel Bowie.
You know, we've always had there have always been very wealthy people in American life, and for I'd say a good chunk of or most of American history, that most of those people have been more concerned with protecting their wealth than they have with sort of trying to create a more equitable society. I think that's just sort of how societies work. I don't think you can look anywhere in the history of the world and see a place where most of the wealthiest citizens are interested in using their wealth and their power to lift up the floor. That typically happens as a result of ordinary people using their power and using their ability to organize. I don't think the president's any different. So it would be great to have more wealthy people who are interested in sort of doing making the economy more equitable, but I just don't think we can expect. I don't think that's something you can expect to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. Andy, thanks for your call. Let's go to Green Bay next, and Dirk is with us. Dirk, thanks for joining us. Whoops, we lost Dirk. Uh-oh, Dirk, please call back. Your question was a great one, and I wanted to make sure we took it. Well, anyway, thanks, Andy. Hopefully Dirk will call back. One of the things that I wanted to touch on, we've talked a lot about presidential politics, and we're going into the 2016 presidential election cycle. The economy seems to be going pretty well. Gas prices are down, and that's helping everybody. But, you know, we really can't count on that being the case by the time the campaign really gets going. If the economy takes a downturn, who's helped and who's hurt by that, do you think?
Sorry, could you say the last part of the question?
Well, I mean, let's say that once we really get into the 2016 campaign, all of a sudden next year, okay, next year the economy takes a nosedive for whatever reason, who knows. Anything is possible and often happens. So the economy takes a nosedive in 2016 ahead of the presidential election. Who's hurt and who's helped by that?
I think who's hurt by that are the Democrats. Pretty much, if the economy does not at least stay stable and if it, you know, really if it's not on sort of like a decent upswing, you have to – the only fair, I think, analysis is that the Republicans have the advantage. It may not be a big advantage. It may just be a slight advantage, but they have the advantage nonetheless. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing to remember about 2016 is that the Democrats will be attempting to hold the White House for a total of 12 years. And in general, it just doesn't happen. Parties tend not to hold whole offices for that long. The last time it happened was George H.W. Bush in 1988. And before that, it was Harry S. Truman. Generally speaking, something dramatic has to happen in the world for that kind of thing to happen. So for me, entering into 2016, my going assumption is that all things equal, Republicans have the advantage.
Let's Dirk is back with us. Dirk, sorry we lost you before. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question, I guess, is for the guest. Mentioned, I was listening to him talking about the visit from Netanyahu that Boehner extended an invitation for, and that it's, I guess, disrespectful towards the president. Obviously, there's a lot of turmoil in the Middle East that Congress, the new Congress, needs to get a lot of information on to try to learn how to deal with that. And obviously, talking with our one major ally over there is a good way to try to come up with some policy or some ideas to how to deal with it. And my, I guess, question is, you know, for him to invite him, inviting another Netanyahu there, why would he need to ask permission? If there's three equal branches, you know, it's like if I'm asking permission to an equal partner, can I bring him over to talk to us to try to get some ideas or discuss some things? Is there respect there? Obviously, there's not much respect between the two initially. So I guess my question is, why would there need to be permission mm-hmm. granted by a president to have somebody from Netanyahu come visit?
Okay, Dirk, thanks for the question. And let's be sure to clarify that then. Jamel, can respond to Dirk, please.
In my, you know, my answer, I guess, would be that right now there are sensitive negotiations happening between the White House and really between the United States and Iran. There's also an election happening in Israel involving a party that is very aggressive towards Iran and wants to isolate Iran more than it wants to engage with it. Inviting Netanyahu to speak, I don't think Boehner necessarily owes, as a matter of sort of like policy or institution, an explanation or or need to ask permission from the president. I don't think that's the case. But I do think that when it comes to something like this, it's very sensitive. What it looks like, even if this is not the intention, but it looks like it's a deliberate attempt to put pressure in the other way, to try to make foreign policy by way of the speaker's chair. And I just think that's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. If the shoe was on the other foot, if it were a Democratic speaker and a Republican president, I'd feel the same way. This isn't a case of Democrats trying to reach an agreement with Iran. This is the case of the United States trying to do it, and I think that just creates a different dynamic.
Well, and we do have a State Department and a Secretary of State who's been conducting foreign policy. Clearly, not everybody is on the same page, and there are a number of agendas going. Let's try and sneak in one more call. Sam in Crandon, we'll go to you very quickly because we've only got about a minute and a half left. Go ahead.
So I was just wondering, like 2 months ago before the election, or, you know, about 2 months ago, we go from unpopular president, immigration not so popular, you know, economy not so good, and they voted out a lot of the Democrats. Then he doesn't listen to what people are saying and still does the, you know, unpopular thing with the illegal immigration. And then gas prices come down, and now all of a sudden the economy is booming. It seems like things kind of turned a corner all of a sudden. And they're giving him all the credit for low gas prices and a good economy. One, I don't really see how much the economy has turned around that much in 2 months, but, you know, I guess it wasn't really a clear question or anything, but I was just wondering your thought on that.
Sure. Sam, thanks so much. The president gets blamed when gas prices go up, but we don't like to give him credit when they go down. That seems to be the popular way things are viewed these days. Jamel, quickly, what about what Sam is talking about? Was there some sudden turnaround?
Yeah, I mean, so I think what we're seeing in the president's popularity is it is the case that nationwide the economy has been growing. It is the case that nationwide wages have been going up. And I think the downturn in gas prices, which has nothing to do with anything the White House has done, has made people feel like their prospects are getting better. I think the caller gets to something very important about the American system, which is that in the media, we talk about elections as if they are a referendum on particular policies. Elections are kind of just random. They often turn on events out of control or out of, like, significant control from the people in leadership. And so, you know, let's say Hillary Clinton gets elected next year because the economy just happens to be good. In some way, that isn't quite fair because she had nothing to do with that. Obama only had limited control over that. It's sort of very arbitrary. Mm-hmm. But this is why our system is so has such a strong status quo bias, why it's so mm-hmm. hard to get things done because, you know,
Jamel. Yeah, got to break in. We're out of time. I'm sorry. We could talk about this all day. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Jamel Bowie is a Slate staff writer covering politics, policy, and race. KP Whaley produced this hour. Scott Myers handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.